Hi, TYT. I'm Katie Halper, and I'm really excited to be talking with a really brilliant guest, if I do say so myself. Her name is Brianna Joy Gray, and she is a writer. Her pieces appear in places like Rolling Stone, The Guardian, New York Magazine. She's an editor at Current Affairs Magazine, and in really exciting news, she just joined The Intercept, where she'll be a senior political editor. So welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be doing at The Intercept? Or is that like top secret and something The Intercept itself will be doing exposés on?
I don't think it's top secret. I mean, I'm going to be joining Ryan Grimm in D.C. as a senior politics editor starting next month. And I'll be there in D.C. for 3 months, getting to know the writers there so we can start to develop our editorial relationship. And then I'll be back in New York and just going down periodically. But yeah, I'll be a full-time editor, and I think the hope is that, especially as we move into midterms and get closer and closer to 2020, I start to write more and more, and that becomes a greater share of my responsibilities.
And your focus is going to be on what?
Politics.
And the DNC, the Dems, is that?
There was an initial article that characterized
right.
it that way and kind of framed me as the editor that's going to be the authority on the kind of the Bernie left or the divide between the left and the center left.
Right.
But I don't know that the idea is that narrow.
Wow,
I think that I'm not sure where that writer got
sounds
that
like
from.
There's some intrigue there. It sounds like Glenn Greenwald or Jeremy Scahill has to do an expose about that. Correct the record.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Jeremy, Glenn, whichever one does it, make sure you email me that before it's released, when it's still embargoed. So speaking of the divide between the center-left and the left-left, what are the takeaways from 2016? And some people would respond to what you just said about the Bernie left as relitigating the 2016 elections. What's your response to that?
I don't see it that way. I think that the 2016 election opened up a genuine rift and shifted the Overton window so that a lot of people are now thinking critically about how the world could be in a way that is not at all pie in the sky. I think things seem like a real possibility now. And that gulf between the people who've kind of had that shift and the people who haven't isn't going to go away. And I think that the lines are going to be drawn in 2020 when we're talking about potential Democratic candidates along those lines. And it's important for the general public who isn't quite so online and I think kind of waist deep in all of that muck every day the way that we are to have people who can translate what the division is about and so they can make an informed decision about what side of it they're actually on.
Yeah, I mean, even just now when you and I were both kind of fumbling, not in a bad way, in a very smart way. But I mean, I find myself doing this all the time. I'm like, the left, liberal, you know, and people who aren't really in it don't get it. And they're like,
right.
Wait, I thought he was left. Wait, Bernie's liberal?
Right.
No, Bernie's left, Hillary's liberal? It is confusing. And you don't want to alienate people who
right.
aren't really fluent in that terminology. But at the same time, we want to define those movements, right? And we don't
right.
want to like sugarcoat or step over this important division. What do you say to people who call you and me dividers?
You know, I think it takes two to tango. But my approach generally, especially in the things that I write, is to kind of have an approach that is targeting those that don't necessarily agree with me and to do so in a way that isn't combative or judgmental. You know, it's one of the driving ethos is behind Current Affairs, which is Nathan Robinson, the editor there, the founding editor, likes to say that he pitches the magazine is for people who don't know that they're leftist.
Oh,
you know,
like
the magazine is for people who might not already identify so strongly with the left the way that maybe someone who reads Jacobin might already
right.
do. And so the tone there is very much, you know, explanatory and ideologically forceful, but not judgmental or angry, or it doesn't devolve into kind of the shaming type of rhetoric that you often see in the mainstream.
Right. Speaking of which, you wrote a great piece called The Politics of Shame for Current Affairs. Can you tell us what the politics of shame is, and why they don't work?
Yeah, so generally, I read a psychological study a while back that talked about the difference between shame and guilt and the kind of emotional responses that shame in particular evokes. And what we know is that when people feel shamed, they feel like their entire self is being judged holistically, in the way that when they feel guilt, they don't. So if I tell you, if I shame you, a person begins to feel, I'm a bad person for having done this thing or thought this way. Whereas if you critique behavior in a more narrow realm of behavior, for instance, and just, talk to somebody about why their behavior might have had bad consequences in a way that doesn't go to that shaming place, they're more likely to just correct their behavior and understand that their entire being isn't under assault. So what we saw, I think, in the aftermath of 2016, for understandable reasons, given the real implications of Trump's election, that a lot of people on the left, center left, however you want to define it, were saying things like, how dare they? Who are these 53% of white women? And, talking about deplorables and the very notion of reaching out to a Trump voter, which is on the whole just any regular schmegular Republican voter that we've always had, as being kind of beyond the pale. People being kind of categorically beneath political notice. And there's a kind of rhetoric that almost borders on a kind of a dehumanization, which I certainly understand given the implications of what's happening here, but which I think is not particularly politically productive.
Right. Exactly.
So in the article, I encourage people to think about the kinds of language they use and the result they actually want to get. And the result should be a different electoral outcome next time around. And what kind of satisfies a person emotionally in terms of shaming isn't always the most productive thing politically.
And what was this psychology study?
It's funny. I found it years and years ago. It wasn't something that was written from a political perspective at all, but more generally. And I stumbled across it in the context of trying to understand and reevaluate a relationship that had recently gone awry.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think that
I wish I had read that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has some broader implications, and there's links in the article if anybody's interested.
And so were you, let's just get a little personal, were you shaming, were you guilt tripping, were you shamed, were you guilt tripped, or was it mutual?
I felt that my partner at the time was very sensitive to criticism because he was not able to translate it as like guilt, like something more productive.
Right.
And so that any minor disagreement in the relationship became a really huge deal. And that's a kind of a response that people who have had like trauma in childhood very frequently have. So I don't mean that in a judgmental way about him, but it became a real obstacle to us moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people like that from, some experience I've had, with other people, will shut down, mm-hmm. right? So they're not open to the criticism. And I think it's really important. What we see a lot online especially is this shaming that's emotionally satisfying maybe to the shamers, but that actually, like you said, is politically counterproductive. Because if the goal is to get would-be Trump voters to vote for the non-Trump candidate nominee, why do we prioritize our feelings of kind of satisfaction and vengeance over appealing to people who we need? I mean, we just need numbers-wise.
Yeah, I mean, fine, do it. Do it at home with your like-minded
sure.
people, but just know that it's not getting you very far. And more than even just alienating people, a focus on shaming can distract Democrats from what are the facts on the ground that are actually more able to change a voter's mind.
Right.
So in the article, I used the example of the Roy Moore debacle, in which the approach from the left tended to be just to focus on the fact that he had been accused of molesting all of these young girls. And they said things like, how could people vote for him? He's a child molester. You must just be monsters if you would rather support a child molester. When studies show that, in fact, what was happening on the ground was that people who supported him simply didn't believe the news reports. So you had what was actually a crisis of media trust being kind of erased as just kind of like a moral failure. And so once you know that there's something else that's much more accessible than somebody's moral ideology that you can actually have an influence on, well, then you can take a step. You can say, okay, how do we get people to trust the media? Can we get authorities in here who are maybe on the right who can start to talk to people and explain to them that there's actually credibility to these charges that are being made against him? But if you are stuck in this place where you jump to a conclusion that other people are just monsters, even if they're actions might be monstrous and we disagree with them ethically a great deal, it starts to be a kind of blinder that ultimately impairs your ultimate goal. Mm.
This is a related question. You write a lot about identity politics, and you've written some really formative pieces. And one distinction you make that's really important is the difference between identity politics and the weaponization of identity politics. So could you describe that?
Right. So a lot of people, particularly on the right, who have a problem with identity politics, you know, they do in fact have an issue with the very nature of the beast, which is to say that we all are born into a community that recognizes certain identities and bestows them with certain rights or privileges depending on who we are, right? So identities didn't come out of a vacuum. You know, I didn't wake up and decide to be black any more than you woke up and decided to be white. We live in a society that has a history of saying that being black or being white means certain kinds of things, right? So people have developed political identities around these because they've needed to lobby for certain rights and privileges to gain equality. And there have been cultural implications of that as well. Nobody really doubts or misunderstands the reality of an Irish identity or a Jewish identity or various identities from across the world. What people start to take an issue with, some on the right, is the idea that kind of we have politicized our identity in a way that they feel like they don't have access to because whiteness hasn't historically been seen as an identity. So that's a whole group of people who are kind of in the muck over there. But there are a lot of people on the left that criticize who have kind of taken identity politics, which is a genuine thing that I've just described, and used it for political ends that aren't always in lockstep with the kind of best interest of the groups that they claim to be representing. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about weaponizing identity. And we saw a lot of examples of this in 2016, where we saw the fact that Bernie Sanders was a white man and the fact that Hillary Clinton was a woman used as a stand-in for what their actual politics were about. So the fact that Hillary Clinton has historically been much more equivocal about abortion rights, for instance, or the fact that she selected a vice presidential candidate who has a record of you know, requiring young underage girls to get parental approval and all the same kinds of
that he wouldn't repeal the Hyde Amendment.
All the kinds of pro-life policies that we criticize, the left tends to criticize from the right, those were kind of erased by the fact that Hillary Clinton herself was a woman. And we saw that, we see this with a lot of candidates of color as well, where the fact that they might have been a prosecutor and bragged about how effectively they locked people up as a district attorney in California, I'm talking about Kamala Harris, is kind of washed over by virtue of the fact that they are black, and criticisms of those candidates is often attributed to racism, even when they are substantive.
And even when, more ironically, when they are actually racist policies, right?
Right.
So, I mean, we obviously incarceration has a lot to do with racism.
Of course.
But I just want to make sure you knew this, that in Africa, they call her sister. They call Hillary Clinton sister. Peter Dow tweeted. So that does change things a bit.
Well, he's the king of it, right?
Yes.
He had that poll out. He's someone who has identified as white online, at least historically. He's half Lebanese. So he recently did a Twitter poll to ask people if he should start identifying as a person of color. Do I count as a person of color? And I certainly am not one to want to police his identity or how he chooses to identify. He's Lebanese. My Arab American friends consider themselves to be right. People of color. Right on. But the fact that he was now choosing to identify this way to insulate him from a certain kind of criticism online and to kind of be able to have leverage in debates where people privilege the perspectives of people of color, that seemed to me to be rather perverse.
Right. I mean, it also shows you how he does have white privilege if he has to grapple with this, right?
Right.
Like you were saying, you didn't choose to be black, I didn't choose to be white. You wouldn't be on Twitter like, hey guys, here's a poll, should I start identifying as black? He's also he was torn because he could also identify as a keyboardist and a musician. I want to also talk about, in terms of identity politics, something really interesting that happens is that people get it on some level, right? Like if you say Sarah Palin isn't good for women, or you say Clarence Thomas isn't good for black people, they get it. They get that there's a distinction between a person's identity and their politics, right? But they, for some reason, I guess they don't get it with Hillary, and there we go again, relitigating the primaries. They don't get it when it comes to Hillary and Bernie as much because they seem to be closer. And I'm certainly someone who, if all things being equal and we had a female candidate and a male candidate, I'd say go with the female candidate. But there were significant differences. And I'll always remember Hillary's speech where she said, is breaking up the banks going to end racism? No. Right. Which to me kind of encapsulates the weaponization of identity politics, right? Because what she's saying is, will economic changes, economic reforms solve racism, which is a straw man, a straw person, because no one pretends that it's going to get rid of racism, right? At the same time, we all know that housing issues and breaking up banks, all those issues, they have a lot of racial implications.
Black Americans were disproportionately affected by the financial crisis. The black community lost 40% of its accumulated wealth. That wealth was already at something like 5 cents on the dollar of accumulated white wealth. And besides which, you have, as you pointed out, yes, criminal justice issues. But I read a statistic recently that said 95% of police shootings occur in neighborhoods where the household income is under $100,000 a year. 0% happen in neighborhoods where the household income is over $200,000 a year. You know, of course, class issue, you know, a class focus can't alleviate every race issue, every racial discrepancy that exists. But to try to address those discrepancies without a class analysis is like trying to fight racism with one hand behind your back, because so much of it is deeply intertwined. And so much of the vulnerability that black people are exposed to is because of a lack of access to material resources. So we can play this game where we shuffle kids around to schools as though proximity to whiteness, to white kids, is what's going to cure educational disparities. But the reality is that while throwing money at a school doesn't necessarily affect the quality of school and affect outcomes, you know, there's it helps, but it's not the direct correlation we would like it to be. What we see has a huge effect is the affluence of the family, the amount of resources the family has, the amount the parents are able to be in the house during the daylight hours to read to their children and cook dinners and spend that kind of time together, to feel safe in their communities without the threat of violence constantly. And those are the kinds of things that historically, at least in the last, you know, several decades, the Democratic Party has been less attended to and instead has been focused on these purely identity issues, which are important, but which in and of themselves are insufficient.
You and I have both been accused of being Bernie bros, and I've actually reappropriated that label. So
yeah, I prefer Bernie broad.
Oh, I never got that. I like that. Bernie broad, yeah. We can burn our Bernie bras too. But there is a difference between you and me in that one of us got to travel with Bernie Sanders. I shook hands with him at Riverside Church, but everyone did, so it wasn't special. I almost got to interview him, but I was on a very mediocre date, and I decided for the first time in my life to put my phone away, and that's exactly when one of his press secretaries emailed me, texted me, DM'd me, and left me a message asking if I could interview him. Bernie, let's make it happen. Lots of people call me Bernie Bro. I get Bernie Stan, too. But because I'm a big person, I decided to invite you on anyway.
Well, thank you for your graciousness.
Yes. Took a lot of soul searching. But you went to the South with Bernie Sanders. Can you tell us about how that happened?
So there was an opportunity to travel with the senator. He was in Memphis to commemorate the assassination of Martin Luther King's life and legacy earlier in April. And he and his team were driving that day from Memphis to Jackson, Mississippi, where he was giving another talk with the mayor of Jackson, Chokwe Lumumba. And I was able to join them on that 3-hour car ride between those two cities and then interview him.
Were you in the car?
I was in the car.
With him?
I was in the car with him.
Was there a lot of this, like when he was like pointing to where to
a lot
go?
Of gesticulation?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, not more than I noticed.
Okay.
But I'm not as sensitive to some who found his gesticulations to be kind of overwhelming and even sexist, shall we say,
well,
in the course
you know
of
what
the
I say to those people? You're anti-Semites. I come from a long line of, I actually call it gesticulating. There you go. So get woke.
I felt very comfortable in the cultural context of his, I'll stick with gesticulation.
Yeah. So although I can give you
your, it's your word.
You can have it. I give it to you.
But yeah, that was it. We had a good off the record conversation then, and I was able to interview him the following day or the following Friday, which was very, very interesting because the tone was so different after the event, because as you're well aware, his speech in Jackson that night got a very different reception than I was anticipating after certain members of the press reported only one quotation, which certain people, I think pretty dishonestly, characterized as a criticism of Barack Obama, which people took offense to because it was on this day where we're supposed to be commemorating Martin Luther King.
Yeah, so let's take a look at what was said. Bernie Sanders said, "The business model, if you like, of the Democratic Party for the last 15 years or so has been a failure. People sometimes don't see that because there was a charismatic individual named Barack Obama. He was obviously an extraordinary candidate, brilliant guy, but behind that reality, over the last 10 years, Democrats have lost about 1,000 seats in state legislatures all across the country, all across this country."
That's pretty good.
Thank you. You
good
felt
Bernie.
Like, was that a flashback?
It's like I'm in did the room with them again, exactly. Yeah.
So how did, before we get to the huge backlash that was pretty manufactured, how did the audience respond?
They erupted in applause, and you can watch the tape and you can hear it too.
All white audience?
Absolutely.
All white male?
Absolutely
straight?
Not. You know, a lot of people were saying that on Twitter, and it was really confusing to me because even a New York Times an article by a reporter who was also there, but that ran with a photograph that wasn't particularly favorable to the senator either.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. You're on notice.
Had a picture that showed very clearly that it was a very diverse crowd. Now, it might not have been as diverse as Jackson, which is 85% black, but it was at least 50% non-white. And I think the picture that I saw, I mean, I didn't do a head count,
right. But
it pretty much reflects that. And I remember I took notes about who was sitting just in my immediate vicinity because it was dark and I could only see so far. But I was sitting next to one of Sanders' staff to my left, who was black. I was sitting next to a South Asian guy to my right and his black partner. And there was a white family sitting in front of me, a mother, father, and two little girls who mostly spent the whole time on their devices. And, you know, that kind of breakdown was reflective of what was in the room.
Yeah.
The crowd that night was overwhelmingly positive. There were frequent points at which people erupted into spontaneous applause. The mayor, who I understand is quite popular, did not receive as much fanfare as Bernie Sanders did. In fact, I think when they first came onto the stage,
they're like, "Who's that guy next to Sanders?"
He said something along the lines of, "You know, I'm gonna stop my opening remarks. I know who you really want to see." And the crowd erupted in applause. I mean, everyone was very excited to see him. And when he critiqued the Democratic Party, the people in that room didn't have to be told that was the truth of what what the party had done. People of Mississippi understand the ways in which the Democratic Party had failed them. And as Senator Sanders explained to me in the course of our interview, you know, he's a big advocate of the 50-state solution, the 50-state approach to campaigning, because he feels as though, you know, a state like Mississippi, which is the largest, has the largest population of black voters in the country, at I think 37%, is a place that could be easily flipped blue with a minority of white voters. All you would need is something like 15% of whites in Mississippi to actually come out and vote for a Democratic candidate. But instead, the Democratic Party has completely abandoned the state, including all of its low-income residents. It's also the poorest state in the union. And regardless of what the demographics of the state are, the senator believes that the party should be seeking to support and provide for all of those people. And so what you get is a capital city, which is predominantly black, where a lot of the kind of economy that drives the economy, which is basically fleeced by the rest of the state and distributed outward. You have pothole jokes being the number one kind of like cultural touchstone when I was there in the city. Everybody talked about how the failing infrastructure, the fact that the Capitol was out without water earlier in the winter, because the pipes had burst, and there's some pipes apparently that are so old they're from like the revolutionary days, and nobody knows how to fix them, wooden pipes and things like that. And the legislature was out using porta potties. I mean, these are the conditions there, but this is the kind of state which is kind of written off as full of deplorables, who are again beneath political notice, and that's something that the senator wants to change.
And of course, the people who suffer, right? Even if you don't have any empathy for these so-called deplorables, the people who suffer are the very people that people are claiming to care about, the disenfranchised, right? Who has suffered disproportionately.
Right.
So Sanders made those comments, and I'm not sure if he was the first person, but one of the first people to respond to them was Bakari Sellers, who's a former South Carolina state rep and a Clinton surrogate and a CNN commentator and also a major fan of AIPAC, and he's gotten his photo taken with Sheldon Adelson, who I would like to, like in the draft, like I'd like to give him away as a Jew. I really don't want him on our team. He's a huge Republican donor. I would think that he would maybe, like, that Sellers would maybe be embarrassed and, like, try to turn around. Maybe got photobombed by Sheldon Adelson, but he actually posed with him, which is interesting. When the Bernie Sanders quote was reported by BuzzFeed, he tweeted, "Y'all can defend Bernie all you want. On MLK 50, his lack of self-awareness and arrogance in dismissing number 44, Barack Obama, is wild. Bernie 2020 died 4/4/18. Okay, first of all, Bakari, lack of awareness, you're talking about a commemoration of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King on April 4th, and you think that's a good time to metaphorically describe the death of Bernie Sanders. But it looks like you're the one comparing Bernie and MLK.
It's actually a really good point.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was preparing for this and I was like, wait a second, how does that happen? And no one noticed that? It seems pretty insensitive. Y'all can defend Bakari all you want. On MLK 50, his lack of self-awareness and arrogance in dismissing Martin Luther King in order to attack Bernie Sanders is wild. Bakari Sellers self-owned that day. But then the New York Times wrote a piece that you were referring to, and it said, Mr. Sanders faced sharp criticism from some African Americans who thought he'd reduced the nation's first black president, Barack Obama, to merely being what Mr. Sanders called a charismatic individual. So I don't know where this merely comes from.
Oh, man. I had a whole thing when I had my first draft of this article where I was like, where does this guy get this merely? Like, I don't know. I'm new to this journalism game, but to me that was a not insignificant integrity lapse.
Yeah.
It completely changes the character of what was said to throw a merely in there.
Yeah, totally.
What Sanders said was expansive, not limiting, about what what the character and phenomenon of Barack Obama
right.
was about.
Yeah, he called him, it wasn't just charismatic, he actually called him obviously an extraordinary candidate, brilliant guy, yeah. What's interesting, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying about identity politics and how, you know, identity per se doesn't always align with politics, but Bakari Sellers actually wrote a letter that was signed by 60 African-American leaders telling the Democratic Platform Committee to not describe the occupation, Israeli occupation, as an occupation. And again, he's an AIPAC representative. AIPAC is the American Israeli Political Action Committee. And it's interesting that, you know, as much as he likes to present himself as a activist for racial equality, that just totally dehumanizes or dismisses Palestinian suffering.
You know, it's funny too, because I feel as though disproportionately in my experience, a lot of black Americans have a natural affinity for the Palestinian plight. And so that he would do this, that he would, you know, take it upon himself, you know, as a black person who should be able to have that kind of identity of spirit, is particularly disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, it's colonialism, right?
Like, yes.
Yeah. So you wrote about going with Bernie Sanders to the South for New York Magazine. And you wrote, although I, a black woman, was a supporter of Sanders in the 2016 Democratic primary, on some level I had succumbed to the persistent narrative that Sanders has a black problem. The claim is that Bernie Sanders, who does indeed appear more comfortable explaining how class-based programs can benefit the 99%, than discussing the struggles endemic to historically marginalized communities simply doesn't get us. So I asked Sanders what he thought about critics who say he seems to care more about white voters than people of color. It's just not true, he said. Sanders explained that he believes his agenda, which includes Medicare for all and free public education, will have an especially profound and positive effect on communities of color. And you keep going, Brianna, you write, and he's right. Blacks and Latinos are respectively 2 and 3 times more likely to be uninsured than whites. And although Black Americans are about as likely to enroll in college at a higher rate than any other racial group, we are less likely to matriculate, in part due to difficulty paying for college. And then you quote Sanders again, Senator Sanders. Having said that, is racism a very significant and powerful force in American society that has got to be addressed? The answer is absolutely. Will a Medicare for all or single payer system end racism in America? No, it won't. So above and beyond moving forward on strong national programs, we've got to pay a special attention to communities of color, which are especially hurting right now. Quote, so it's not either or. It's never either or. It's both. It is making sure every American has high quality health care as a right, the right to excellent education, but is also addressing the special problem of racism, of sexism, of homophobia, etc. Said like a real homophobic racist misogynist. You go on to write, when I ask for examples of identity-specific programs that cannot be resolved by class-based initiatives, Senator Sanders identified the need to improve access to home ownership, which plays a key role in the racial wealth gap, as well as police reform. He specifically praised the work of Philadelphia's progressive DA, Larry Krasner, who now requires the incarceration cost be stated on the record at sentencing, and he emphasized the need for police reform. What we've got to do is have national police training, which says that lethal force is the last response and not the first response. So you asked an incredibly important question, which a lot of people don't ask, which is, yeah, okay, we know that breaking up the banks isn't going to end racism, Hillary Clinton. We also know it will help. But what are the things that need to be addressed, not by class programs, but actually specific racial programs? And he answered this. Now, I think what's interesting is if you asked a lot of people that question, a lot of the people who call him a Marxist class reductionist, they wouldn't be able to say that.
It's true, and I've done that on Twitter, and yeah, I've seen them stumble.
Right.
Criminal justice reform is, I think, the one that people kind of go to in the Black Lives Matter movement. But even, you know, even that has a lot of class-based implications. And studies have shown that class is correlated very strongly to police violence as well as race. And that's not to undermine one or the other. But I think, I had someone on Twitter recently say to me, you know, LeBron James was pulled over by the cops, therefore class doesn't matter. And I was like, well, how many times did LeBron James end up on the street with a bullet in his back? And if he had, would the person who shot him be as likely to get off the hook as if he were a person without means?
Right.
You know, how often, you know, what are the percentage of times that someone with the affluence and means of LeBron James are pulled over versus working class Black Americans who are dogged by the fact that they are pulled over, given tickets disproportionately, have troubles paying for those tickets, you know, and therefore have a problem that accumulates. You know, the idea that just because race is a factor that operates independently from class and that can't be solved by class means that class doesn't matter is incredibly myopic.
Right, and you could look at class stuff and use that argument to say race doesn't matter.
Of course.
And we don't do that because we're intersectionalists.
Well,
okay, thank you so much, Brianna Joy Gray. Thank you so much for joining us on TYT Interviews. And we will see you next time.